Thank you, Rabbi Grossman. I like that introduction. It was dripping with warmth. Before I even continue with my remarks, first of all, for me, it's a bit of a homecoming, although I've come home often enough. But as was referred to, Rabbi Grossman mentioned that I learned here in yeshiva, and I had this chus of learning yeshiva. I had some of my old chaverim that are here, and chavrusas that are here, some antagonists that are here. But we're all here as good friends and family. And in my days, I remember when I was here in Lakewood, the old Kletzkas would come and say, "I can't believe that this is what happened in yeshiva. When we were here with 75 Talmidim." And now, coming back here now, you can build three Lakewoods that in my days, in Tafshin Lamed Beis, that area, in just in one square block here. So, but I do have mishpacha here, daughters. And so I do come here, but it's, I think, the first time, I hope not the last time, that I've actually had the opportunity to address a Lakewood Olam publicly. Reference was made to Mr. Jerry Keene, who is sitting to my left. Jerry is, as was mentioned, the director of technical, of quality assurance for Ventura Foods. Ventura Foods is a huge conglomerate of, it was a conglomerate of various companies, Wholesome, Wilsey Foods, that joined as one venture and now became Ventura Foods over the last number of years. They have plants from coast to coast. They line the West Coast. They're in Alabama. They're in Texas. They're spread throughout the entire country. Primarily what Ventura Foods produces, most of the food they produce, you, unless you're in the food industry, would not see off the shelf. It's mayonnaise, but in, you know, gallon sizes, totes of oil, dressings, mostly for the food industry. However, they do some retail packs of dressings and retail packs, that are familiar, including some Planters products that they pack, but they are very much an oil-based company, and so I thought that it would be proper to bring Jerry to this event tonight. And Jerry, all I can say is he sometimes mentions the R word, which is retirement, and I don't know what I'm going to do if Chalila that ever takes place. But he's just a wonderful source, a wonderful resource, and a terrific person to get to know. And it's been a pleasure to work with him over the years. Jerry's here in case there are too many questions that I can't handle, which can happen often enough, and soon enough, I can always deflect to my assistant over here, Mr. Jerry Keene, and set the record straight. I see Rabbi Lubin is walking in, who will be speaking after we finish here, and it's a cover to welcome him. Okay, so let's get to the topic at hand. The topic we were titled, Schmaltz is Us. Schmaltz represents anything that has to do with oil and oil-based product. Yes, it's true. I will try to steer clear of palm oil. If you have any questions in that regard, I may be able to give you general answers, but we know that palm oil, the imported oil, the tropical oils coming from overseas, was a controversy, especially over the summer. It was dealt with and is still being dealt with the OU and some of the major organizations. For the most part, the chashashas that were raised as far as their being contained in adjacent holds with non-kosher items, most of those suspicions and the fears have been laid to rest. So I will not really, and there's somebody specific in the OU that deals with it, Rabbi Gavriel Price, so I will... unless I'm pressed, I will really rather not talk about that topic. If you feel something you must raise, we'll deal with it to the extent that we can. Because I deal with domestic oil. Now, with domestic oil in the United States, we have to say at the outset that at this point in time, most, and Jerry, you're listening, and you can nod your head in disagreement at any time. Most, the overwhelming majority of oil that is vegetable oil produced in the United States comes from all kosher plants. This may not have been the case maybe even 10 years ago, but the overwhelming majority of oil produced in the United States with or without any hashgacha happens to come from all kosher plants. When I say all kosher plants, that means that what's produced in these plants is of a kosher variety of oil only, which is primarily, when we talk about vegetable oil, I also wonder as a kid, what does it mean, vegetable oil? I can't squeeze any oil out of lettuce or a cucumber. Vegetable oil primarily is referring to soybean, corn oil, canola oil, cottonseed oil. Those are the major oils that are produced domestically in the United States. You have olive oil, which is, comes for the most part from overseas. Now, those oils are refined from the grain, from the seed, and they are produced in factories that deal exclusively with these type of oils. The non-kosher oil that was somewhat prevalent in this country was lard-based oil or tallow-based oil. Lard coming from pig, from hog, and tallow-based oil could be like a beef-based oil. There's very little of that in the United States. To my mind, as far as I can realize in my own mind, there are only two plants in the United States that still produce beef or tallow-based oil or lard-based oil, and one is in Chicago, and one in the Chicago area, one is also in Illinois, but is most likely going to stop producing, actually producing altogether. So, most oil in the United States, as I say, is kosher. Now, that is helpful in many respects, of course, because in case someone accidentally uses uncertified oil, to a certain degree of comfort, we can tell the consumer that there's a likelihood that it's all kosher. But nonetheless, even with that, given the fact that most oil is produced in kosher-only plants, and that obviates the need to kosher, that obviates the need to monitor trucking coming in and coming out, that obviates the need to see to it, to see that all the lines from the refinery coming from one side, the refinery and the lines coming from the other side of the refinery are not crossing each other with lard and vegetable oils, it makes the supervision all that much easier. Nonetheless, of course, there are kosher concerns. The kosher concerns at this point would be things like the defoamers that go into making the oil. As the name implies, when you refine an oil and it agitates, it can create a certain amount of foam on top. There are defoamers that are used to actually reduce the amount of foam that is produced on the top of the oil as it agitates and as it gets refined. So those defoamers have to be kosher. There are catalysts that are part of the refining process, nickel catalysts that are little hockey pucks that are used in the refining process. You have to make sure that those nickel catalysts, A, are kosher, B, haven't been used in some non-kosher service as well. And perhaps what's the biggest thorn in the side is making sure that the trucking that hauls the oil to and from the producer, from the refiner, is of a kosher variety. The trucks themselves have been inspected to make sure that they have been carrying kosher loads before, or they have been undergoing a koshering process. What I'm going to do is move on a little bit, try to cover some ground, and then I will refer to what we have prepared here, just to give you a glimpse of what it goes actually into producing oil and oil-based products. Oil-based products would include dressings such as mayonnaise, of course the oil itself, mayonnaise, margarines, which is a big item for Ventura Foods, shortenings, and emulsifiers are all oil-based products. Now, it should be noted right here, and I think Jerry, I'll ask you to corroborate this. To my knowledge, there is no such thing as an all-parve margarine producer in the United States. In other words, you don't, except for maybe a small plant, a mom-and-pop plant, someplace hidden in the back street in New Jersey somewhere, But all the major margarine producers, including those that are from the quote-unquote Hamish brand, are produced in plants that are produced dairy and parve. So every place that produces, no matter what the ethnic brand of, and no matter what the hashgacha is, on a margarine, has to undergo kashering. So that if a hashgacha prides itself that we don't kasher, and it's a standard that's admirable, but if they pride themselves we don't kasher, then that cannot be the case in margarine. Because all margarine facilities produce dairy, and they produce parva margarines on the same line. I'll ask you, Jerry, would you agree that that's basically...
Yeah.
Right.
There's nobody that's strictly a parva plant.
Right.
It's almost impossible to stay in business.
And that right, almost impossible to stay in business. There was one small, relatively small margarine producer. He just started producing margarine somewhere in New Jersey, and he bought his own machines, his own equipment. He was producing parve margarine, and I told him, keep this parve, and you'll probably gain a whole sector of business. Keep it parve only, because then you'll get these certifications that don't want to know about koshering. He said, Rabbi, I just can't do it. So he kept it parve for about a half a year. And now he's doing butter blends as well. Because, as you say, there's just not enough business to go around for all parve. So every margarine house produces parve as it does dairy, and therefore it necessitates koshering from dairy as well. The mayonnaise is, to a certain extent, a safe... rather safe item to produce from a kosher standpoint. Primarily what mayonnaise is oil. That's the main ingredient in mayonnaise is oil, and it's eggs. You have light mayonnaise, which might do without the egg yolk, and might do with the egg albumin. They might have reduced oil, and make up for the reduced oil with certain thickeners and starches. But mayonnaise is all cold production. And that's why, from a kosher standpoint, mayonnaise represents a safer type of production. There are less issues. Even though there have been urban legends about mayonnaise that continue to plague the industry for many years. For example, Hellman's mayonnaise, to this day, there's this legend that you just can't be rid of. I get these calls all the time. We heard that Hellman's mayonnaise is dairy. Is that true? It's not true. And Hellman's mayonnaise is not dairy, never was dairy. Regular mayonnaise is never made with a dairy component. And Jerry, you'll disagree with me anytime. Just let me know. Have no fear.
I won't disagree with you.
Okay, but Jerry, I am correct in saying that light mayonnaise can on occasion be made with a dairy component to compensate for some of the missing fats. Some of the missing flavors, you can have a dairy, a buttermilk introduced. So on occasion, you'll find a light mayonnaise containing dairy.
Very rare.
But it is rare, but that's where it happens. And perhaps that is may have happened with Hellman's mayonnaise. They may have had years ago, it's not today, they may have had a variety of light mayonnaise that had a dairy component, and the word went out, Hellman's mayonnaise is dairy. I get that all the time, and I get calls from Lakewood in that respect, so it's important to let the word out here. Not Hellman's, not Ventura's, not the other brands that you know of, the regular mayonnaise is never an issue of it being dairy. So mayonnaise, you have the standard issues. Where's the oil coming from? Where are the eggs coming from? Making sure that the starches are all proper. Yes? Well, Jerry, I'm going to get to you a second. An OUD store brand mayonnaise, I would be very surprised if it's a regular mayonnaise, a light mayonnaise. Because the reason why I say I would be surprised is because mayonnaise is produced all cold. I'm not sure if I emphasized that. Mayonnaise is produced all cold from the beginning to the end of the process. It's produced on all cold equipment. Therefore, there's never a problem that it's made on dairy equipment, because it can't become Milchix in any case. So I don't know where you can find an OUD on a regular, maybe on a light, but on a regular mayonnaise not.
rather than screaming. You've got to understand that mayonnaise has a standard of identity set by the federal government. The standard of identity allows certain things and doesn't allow certain things. If you call it mayonnaise, it cannot contain starch, it cannot contain gum. If you call it a reduced calorie mayonnaise or a light mayonnaise, it can contain those items. As far as dairy ingredients in mayonnaise, unless they're using some type of a flavor that has a dairy component, I would be very surprised. I can honestly say I've never seen a mayonnaise with an OUD stamp on it, or a dairy stamp from any certifying agency. I guess there may be some, but certainly not in my experience.
Okay. Sauces, on the other hand, like barbecue sauces, but before I get to sauces, let me stick to the mayonnaise type of applications. Related to mayonnaise is salad dressings. When I talk about, pourable salad dressings, standard wishbone type of salad dressings, the French dressings, the Russian dressings. Now, salad dressings like those are also, for the most part, made on all cold equipment. Perhaps at the beginning stages, some pasteurization is necessary, but for the most part, the process involved in salad dressings is all cold. Therefore, also from a kosher standpoint, the salad dressings are minimal as far as the headaches in making sure that the equipment is kosher, because there's nothing to kosher. For the most part, it's all cold. Certainly where the flavors are added, which might create the problems. Let's say it's a Caesar-type dressing which can contain some type of wine. We have a blue cheese dressing which contains a tray of cheese. That's added further down the line after any any hot process has been undertaken. Now, I would also say, and Jerry, here it's important that you corroborate me on this, that these dressings, these salad dressings, and I would say across the board, are made in kosher, non-kosher applications. In other words, all the major producers of salad dressings that we know of, whatever brand name you can think of, and therefore means that all the kosher varieties of salad dressings as well, which are made in these plants, private labeled for them, are all made in places that produce kosher and non-kosher dressings. So there's the same plant that will produce, and on the same equipment, that will produce a kosher French dressing, or a kosher Russian dressing, will also produce a non-kosher cheese dressing. And to complicate matters, you can have dairy and parv on the same line. Meaning, they say if you have a light Italian dressing that might be dairy. A regular Italian or a creamy that might be dairy. You have creamy Italian dressings that are parve, some are dairy. But you have a creamy Italian dressing that will be dairy. And then you can have either a creamy type of Italian dressing that will be parve or a regular Italian dressing that will be parve on the same equipment. So how do the kosher organizations work with that?
With heat?
Right, and there's no heat. And that's the thing. There is no heat. So therefore, it's the mashgiach's job to monitor the production, and usually what every responsible kosher organization does is sees to it that dairy production is done at the end of the day, and treif production is done actually after the dairy production. It goes parv, dairy, treif. Parv, dairy, treif is the schedule for production of salad dressing. Sometimes a company can save their dairy production for the end of the week. Sometimes the company can save their treif production for the end of the week. So what's involved then is a cleaning out of the equipment. Because no heat is involved, what's involved then is a cleaning out of the equipment. And they have some of the equipment comes with a pipes that actually a flow pipe that goes from one tank to the other, part of the part of the production process. And to clean that out, you'd be glad to know there's like a hockey puck shaped disc that they run through the pipe like a wedge, and through pressure it comes through the pipe, cleans it out, rids it of all the residue of whatever dressing may have them in there, and you'd be very glad to know the name of that puck that's used is called the pig. The pig. That's what it's called. So you're eating, the best of you eating salad dressings here tonight have eaten it with something cleaned out by a pig. I guess it's called a pig because it consumes everything, as pigs do. It consumes all the residue, all the waste. So here too, when you find, no matter which hashgacha salad dressing that you have, if there are exceptions to the rule, if somebody knows different, I'd be glad to know about that. But as far as I know, every salad dressing company makes treif kosher dairy. And so that's necessary too. You cannot have an all kosher, all parv salad dressing company. They all need to work with this system. Now, we'll move on to emulsifiers. Emulsifiers are very complex, very complicated type of production. I really can't go into it at any specific length over here, but just to explain to you what was haste on emulsifier. And an emulsifier, the purpose of an emulsifier, generally speaking, there are different types of emulsifiers, stabilizers. The purpose of an emulsifier is to bring into a bond two types of ingredients that normally reject or abhor each other. Water and oil abhor each other. You can't mix them. And yet, when you need an emulsion such as a salad dressing, you have to create an emulsifier so that it'll bond the two and make a cohesive mixture of this of the blend. You have innumerable chocolate requires emulsifiers. Almost every type of produced food item in the United States that has both oil plus something else needs an emulsifier to create a bond. Emulsifiers are made by a reaction of oil, usually soybean oil, and glycerin. Now, it doesn't have to be soybean oil. It could be a lard-based oil. The glycerin, if you're familiar at all with glycerin, glycerin can be from a kosher origin. It could be from a non-kosher origin. Most glycerin in the United States, not with the same percentages of kosher oil, because there is a significant amount of non-kosher glycerin, but most glycerin is kosher. But of course, anyone that has a hashgacha, make sure to it that the glycerin coming into the plant is of a kosher variety. Basically, they take it with the soybean oil, and you have to make sure that soybean oil, that's part of the hashgacha, and it's reacted under an intense heat, an intense reactor. The resultant a mixture, which comes out as a goo, is either used as like a gooey paste, or sometimes it's spray dried. That's another issue. Spray drying, a kashmir spray dryers, as like a powdery or sometimes a beaded effect. And those powders, goo, or beads are what's introduced to the product to make sure that there's a cohesion. So a emulsifier is also a kosher concern. Oh, with more and more as time goes on, the emulsifier companies that are in the United States, for the most part, have switched to being all kosher. Is it for health reasons, or is it because, and market reasons, or is it because to keep the kosher market happy? It's a little unclear. One major company that I deal with, I know it's a major emulsifier company. I know that one of their major driving forces in making sure it's an all kosher plant, which it wasn't maybe 6-7 years ago, was the kosher market. So the kosher market is driving a lot of the way things are produced in the United States. And so most emulsifiers in America, but not all, come from all kosher plants. But emulsifiers years back, I'm talking about 30, 40 years ago, a lot of agencies were not concerned. They felt that emulsifiers were nishtana. They relied on those poskim that felt that it's completely nishtana, it's completely chemically altered from its beginning stages, even though it may have started out as lard and trifoglycerin, but it's been altered enough that we don't have to have a cautious concern. Then the agencies, the clout of the agencies began to develop about 20 or so years ago, this came to a stop. And so therefore, there is a major concern that the emulsifier should be of a kosher process. And of kosher origin. Now, one of the major pitfalls, especially when it comes to margarine production, and I might ask Jerry to address that as well, one of the Trucking is one major pitfall. To monitor the trucks, to make sure they come in kosher, they leave kosher, and that what they hauled before was kosher, and you're not getting a backhaul from some truck making a U-turn from some other place he was just at, and now starting to bring in his load of kosher. That's a huge thorn to have to overcome. But one of the major challenges in kosher margarine production, as I said, treif is not even the concern so much anymore because it's not too much. There are some, but not too much treif margarines. But one of the major concerns is remelt. Remelt in every factory or plant in that produces anything that's subject to have to be the standards and the specs of the item have to be reconfigured. Something was made wrong with the product, and it's the type of product that can be sent back to the beginning to be reprocessed all over again. In other words, it can be salvaged, piped back, and start all over again. That's what's, you can refer to either as remelt or rework. Very often enough, that would be considered rework. In other words, company produces something, they realize at the end of the production line, it doesn't read up to their standards or to their specs, or it's not holding right, the product is not in proper formation, its consistency is not what they wanted it to be. Something's wrong with it, they detect it, and this happens every day, it's not unusual. It happens constantly. It's sent back to the beginning of the line to be reworked, and they break it down to its base components, let's say oil, and rework the product all over again. That would be, I would call that rework. Remelt is product that has been returned by the consumer or by the user, by the customer. We're not happy with the product that you gave us. Cans were damaged. You gave us cans of shortening. It's damaged. Take it back. So now they take it back. They have to rework that too in the same way. The big hurdle here is so obvious that you have to take. Now I have dairy. I have powdered margarine. We'll stick with margarine. Dairy and powdered margarine. I have to now. It's got to be remelted. How do I know that the dairy is being shoved back into the dairy line, the parv is being shoved back into the parv line. Sometimes you have what's called it's automatically returned, automatic return lines from the line itself. It just simply goes, they see the specs are not right, it'll go right back to the beginning on its own. So it's dairy here, it goes back to dairy. But or if it's parv here, it'll go right back to the parv on its own loop. There are many, many other problems that we can get involved in that, which I'm not going to address. We'll get too far afield. But number one, you have to make sure that that's actually happening and it's returning properly to its proper origins. But the bigger concern is that often enough, the return is not done manually. It's not done automatically. It's not done in a mechanized fashion, an automated fashion. It's carded. Somebody with a carton full of wrapped margarine, it's in its wrapper still, has to put it into a tank. The wrappers are gotten off, however manually and otherwise. The stuff gets remelted, then carted back to the beginning by human sweat. Now you have to make sure that human being is putting back all the remelt to where it belongs. And so, in other words, the dairy to the dairy, the parv to the parv. Most companies do the way we set up in kosher companies, everything can only be remelted back to dairy. Cannot have any remelt back to parv, so you don't have to be concerned about it. But it still remains a concern because what happens, there are mess-ups. Jerry, do you have anything to say about controlling remelt?
No, you just covered it in your last sentence. We do not allow anything to get remelted back into parv. That solves the problem. The parv can go into the dairy. Nothing ever goes into the parv.
So is there a standard for all that, or do we depend on company?
Okay, so to us, first I was asked, what about treif? So treif remelt, yeah.
There was a question in the back. There is not a mishpia on site all the time. It's company policy, and records are kept, and records are checked.
Okay, so I'll come back to your treif question in a second. But as far as the question about mashgiach, right. So in an all kosher facility such as Ventura is, dairy parv, but it's an all kosher facility, records are kept, immaculate records are kept, and sure is almost as good as golden fluff, but records are kept, and every bit of production can be monitored. But more than that, the mashgiach, when he comes, has to check the records, and he's spot checking to see that that indeed that remelt is going back to where it does belong, back into dairy production. That's part of the job of a mashgiach. So at random he'll spot it. You have to know. People say, "Well, yeah, I need a mashgiach tamidi." It's always after them to have a mashgiach tamidi in every single situation. But you have to know if a company is either going to be sloppy in the way it does things in its record keeping or in its production, or is going to be fraudulent. It will ultimately be caught. It's lo yamalei. If a company is not careful in its record keeping, not honest in its record keeping, it will be caught. And we always tell this to companies. Sometimes company will face the question, "Don't you trust us, Rabbi? Why do you send these rabbis here?" If we didn't trust the company, we wouldn't deal with them because 20 mashgiachim wouldn't help. A good mashgiach will be alert. He'll see to it that the system is maintaining itself and that the remelt is going back to its source. As far as treif remelt is concerned, there's very limited amount of that. We used to have treif remelt. Jerry used to have it in Birmingham. Right. So one of the plants, I can mention it?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, one of Ventura's plants, they bought out a company called Sunnyland Dairies, which is in Birmingham, Alabama, that used to produce tallow-based margarine. No longer does. So increasingly that's the situation. But where there, and in Sunnyland when they did have this, this was a very big problem for us, monitoring to see that the treif margarine does not get remelted back into kosher. So sometimes we'll make the rule that you can't have treif remelt. End of story. You cannot have treif remelt. You have to discard it, or very often these companies will do is sell it off to animal feed. Pigs like to eat, they like to eat salad dressing, they like to eat soybean oil too, reconstituted margarine. They eat anything. But in Birmingham, I'm talking about now about over 10 years ago when they did produce non-kosher, so the wrappers on the non-kosher margarine, then we made them have a different type of wrapper, as a sword-edged wrapper. It had teeth. The wrapper had like teeth to it, so that we can tell when it's in the remelt tank, this is an all-treif remelt tank, and the mashgiach, in those days we had a mashgiach going in there much more often. In that particular plant, which is all kosher now, mashgiach is there 3 days a week. But in those days, which is more than enough for an all-kosher plant, but in those days, mashgiach would go there much more often because we had non-kosher, and he would, the way we could follow this line of the non-kosher was the sword-edged wrapping, which would tell us that this was, that here's where the treifer was. I just want to tell you about the differences in standards in hashgacha. I'm not here to knock any of the other hashgachas, certainly not any of our competing hashgachas, but just people say, what's the difference? And Jerry's colleagues may be asking the same question. You don't accept certain ingredients from certain certificates or certifications. Why not? What's the difference? What do they do that you don't, or what don't they do that you do? So just to give you an idea, I was in a oil company, I'd say it's about 12 years ago, a major oil refinery that refines oil, makes shortening, makes margarine. Treif, kosher, parv, dairy. At that time, and it was such a complex company, now the company is in a different stage of production, but that's what it was in those years. Treif, kosher, parv, dairy. And at that time we had a mashgiach tamidi, just about tamidi. He was there every single day for hours. And someplace out in Illinois. Now, they had this huge, I'm going to refer to it when we get to these pictures here, they had this huge silo, which is a deodorizer, because when crude oil comes in, it has to be deodorized, as the name implies. It has odor, it's a mesh of raw soybean, and it has an odor. That odor has to be taken out. So it goes up these silos up and down under intense heat. This particular company, I came down once because they wanted a kosher, it's deodorizer, which was, it gets caked on under intense heat. You have to literally, in this case, any case, you had to jackhammer off the coated oil that was encrusted over the years of use. And I came down there to try to figure out, and of course in consultation with others, because I'm not the mumper to figure this all out, but at least to report back what the needs were of how to kosher this deodorizer, which is a Treif deodorizer. Okay, we reported back. Meantime, though, I see that there's oil going over this Treif deodorizer, and it's being packaged with a certain kosher symbol on it. I would venture to say most of the chevra sitting here know enough, you know, not to particularly use this particular hashgacha. But it had a symbol on it, and a nationally, maybe even internationally known symbol. And I said to him, the guy, the foreman's name was Bob. I said, Bob, wait, how are you producing this oil over this? It says kosher on it. How are you producing over this line? He said, Rabbi Schoenfeld. He said, this here is going under the certification of Rabbi so-and-so. So he said, I want you to know he ain't fooling nobody. So he ain't fooling nobody, but the fact is he is fooling a lot of people, because a lot of people see kosher and they see kosher. But that's a situation where the oil is kosher, but it's just not going over lines that have been kosher. That very same hashgacha, I should tell you, had another plant in Texas. We had a mashgiach there, also Tamidi. His name was Rabbi Rubin, who now is in Chicago himself, Rabbi Aaron Rubin. So he was there on a daily basis. When he came into the foreman's office, the manager's office, he did not see the OU certification. He only saw this other certification hanging on the wall. And he said to him, I don't understand. Why do you have his certification hanging on your bulletin board and not ours? He said, Rabbi Rubin, let me explain to you something. I see you every day. I know who you are. I know who the OU is. This rabbi hanging on my wall, if I didn't see that hanging on the wall, I wouldn't remember who he is. And that was from a kosher, non-kosher producing plant at the time. That plant also, by the way, has closed down. Let me just tell you another little vignette on the sort of the other side of the spectrum. I'm not here to knock any self-proclaimed higher standards in kashrus, and some of them, the Hasidic hashgacha, some of them really do wonderful, wonderful jobs. And sometimes we have a tendency, what the Hasidim know in hashgacha? I can tell you, I personally deal with the Balava. You should have an achama with the Nirbaita. Some of these Glick from and the Hisafnis Rabbanu, Rabbi Glick from Muncie. I'm sometimes amazed the amount that they know. Sometimes I can learn from them. So I'm Chalila, and how particular and demanding and careful and in fully sure mind they are. So I'm not here to knock it. But you have to know these. There are people out there too. And there's a Mashgiach, his name is Levi Klein, in Memphis, Tennessee. He does a particular Hashgach in a margarine factory for us. So but he also does for another major agency. I'll tell you, the other agency does this for his Lubavitcher. He does it for the OK as well. So he does an oil refinery for the OK, somewhere in the Memphis area. He gets a call from one of these Heimishes and says, Zugner of Klein, you get Dutton for the OK of the refinery? So he says, yeah. He says, it's an all-kosher refinery? He says, yeah. He says, can't you just make it mahadrin? So he says, how can I make it mahadrin? It's all kosher. What do you want? So he says, it's all kosher. He says, what's nutzman Dutton? He says, oil. We machen the refinery. He says, there's intense heat. There's huge silos. There's intense heat. Esher kenst the machen the flam abyssal hecha. Turn up the flame. He says, look, this is not my home oven. I can't just turn the dial and make the flame higher. And what's it going to do if I did? So I make it hotter. What are you doing? Hasta blowtorch. So he says, yeah, have a blowtorch. Esther kenst again abyssal arun the ganze saladot mit the blowtorch. So he said, that's what I did. I went around a blowtorch like that, made them happy, and now they put on and it's Mahadrin L'Chala Yisum. So you have charlatans on both ends of the spectrum. And that's why you have to be careful when it comes to Hashgachas, because there are different standards and for good reason. We have just a few minutes remaining, and what I prepared here for you over here, just want to take you for a brief tour of what's involved in oil production. I noticed that some of the things are not quite in the sequence they should be. That's my fault. But we'll start on the upper left, which is number one, the crude soybean oil equipment. Now, you have up there on the top, very top left, a thing called an extruder. So basically what happens is when you get soybeans, it's soybean oil or corn oil, canola oil, they are extruded, the oil is extracted from it, and then there are certain chemicals, a hexane, which are to induce the bean to give off even further oil. That's considered crude oil. All the kosher agencies consider crude oil what's called a group one, which means it really doesn't need, we'll accept crude oil of this vegetable oil from any source. We don't care whether it has comes from a certified agency or not. Crude oil is considered kosher from anywhere because nothing happens to it. It's just pressed, and the oil is extracted. Then it has to undergo refining, and that's where, sorry?
How do you know what it is?
No, something else mixed in. You got a big problem. It's how do you know when you buy a pound of peanut butter that you're getting peanut butter? Something else not mixed in. A company orders crude oil, it's going to get crude oil. And if not, they're going to know it in the flesh. Every company has what's called an R&D lab, which means when they receive oil, every shipment that comes in undergoes a test in the lab. Right, Jerry?
Actually, it's quality.
Quality assurance. R&D is actually for production, for exploring production. But it also goes under a lab for a lab analysis. All right, there are certain solvents, chemicals, but they don't concern us from a kosher standpoint. Number two, what you have there is called a tank farm. It's really not so significant, but just to know that much oil is stored in these tank farms until they're used maybe perhaps further down the line in production for margarines and shortenings. Number three and number four, primarily number three, I referred to the deodorizer before. I told you I was down there to try to figure out how to kosher an oil deodorizer, just to give you an idea that this is what it looks like. It's many stories high. It goes up and down with buckets inside under intense heat and rids the oil of its residue. It rids the oil of whatever lingering odor it may have. Number four is either a smaller deodorizer or a component of the deodorizer. Now, what you have in the bottom left is a churn tank. There are many different types of tanks. This is just a typical scene within a margarine or shortening factory. This could also have been inside a mayonnaise factory. But this is what you see. You see the churn, there's a tank on the left that's churning the oil. That from there, now I'm really being very, very concise because we can't, you know, this is not the time or place to get detailed, elaborate about it. But it basically goes from there and is then, now in this particular case, that machine that you see on the right in picture five still, is a type of voltator. Now that's a vote, that's usually, if I'm correct, that probably is a Schroeder. You think that's a Schroeder?
Yeah, it looks like a Schroeder. Just so you'll know, a voltator is nothing more than a swept surface heat exchanger. So you put something in liquid, and the cooling action of the unit causes it to solidify. And you've got literally plastic blades that push the product through because it solidifies in the tube, and then you've got to keep pushing it out. So it's kind of a screw agitation.
Right. In fact, you take a look on the next page on picture nine. That's a standard voltator that's used in most places. On the left is the output, on the right is the input. In other words, the oil, which is already has its blended oil and it's got all its what the additives added, it goes into this voltator at a rather warm temperature, about 70 degrees Fahrenheit, exits the voltator at quite a cold temperature. So what you have is, as Jerry said, it's a tube inside that's with spinning blades. And then there's the coolant is usually what's the coolant?
It's typically ammonia.
Right. So coolant is usually an ammonia-based coolant, and that it'll come out on the other side in a more solid fashion. Back to picture five. So that what I told you there, you see from the churn tank, that big box on the right of picture five. Is a different type of voltator. And by the way, voltator is really a brand name. Voltator is not it's like Scotch tape. But it became the brand name known in the industry. But this is a Schroeder type of voltator. It's a big box. It's more different, But basically, the principle is the same. Now, go to the next page, and where it says, what is that, a five-minute warning or something?
Something like that.
I can't see. Was it going to help? All right. Okay, then you have on the top left a thing called a heat exchanger. And you have an inside diagram of a heat exchanger. A heat exchanger, this is a little bit tricky and cautious. A heat exchanger, this is a way for companies either to pasteurize their liquids. Sometimes they even cook in a heat exchanger. It works very much like a radiator in a car, so that you have your product on one side of a plate and the hot water on the other side of a plate. And that is what either sometimes boosts up the temperature of the water that you may need, or it actually may be used as a pasteurizing process, or sometimes even a cooking process. The big trick in this is that when the heat exchanger becomes either non-kosher or dairy, you can just run it through with hot water and it'll be kosher. Sometimes you have problems because the plates in between are very hard to access, and it's hard to really kosher properly. A votator, we should mention that, a votator could be sometimes very problematic when koshering as well, because a votator sets up the product solidifies as it's spinning down the blades. And it's getting colder as it moves down the tube. It sets up on the blades. So now the hot water, even though you might run it with a hot water flush, and the mashgiach may see all the water coming out and it's clear. So it looks like he's cleaned that votator and the water did its job. But if you open up the votator, and it's not, the companies don't like to do this too often, opening up a votator is because you don't see on this side, but on the other side, there are these big bolts. Big, huge bolts that have to be undone, about six of them, that have to be undone. The tube has to be taken out. Each blade has to be inspected and to see whether the product came off so that you don't have a question of mamashis or be'en still left in the votator. So that is done on occasion. If we feel that a little bit too much time passed in between, we make them clean out the votator in such a fashion. Let me just spend the next, Rabbi Grossman, when did the clock start, 22 or at 8:30? You're on the phone. Now, let's just say that here I'm definitely going to need Jerry's help. Well, hold it. Before we get to Jerry, number 12 on the bottom right, second page, number 12 is called a hopper. I put that in just to give you an idea. A hopper is something when you add usually dry type of ingredients. So when I mentioned before salad dressings, so let's say salad dressings, they're all, for the most part, an oil base, same ingredients. But then they'll go down the line, and after whatever heat has been used, it's been used in straight kosher oil, you know, but when the ingredients are added, and this is where the kosher concern comes in, because you'll add, let's say, some type of treif ingredient, it's done through a hopper, and it goes through this cone type of shaped apparatus, and it's dropped into the product as it goes down the line. That's already after it's all been undergone whatever heat an emulsion that it may have undergone before. So the kashrus nightmare is already done with. Now it's going down the line where the treif, potentially treif, or potentially dairy ingredients are, that is added down the line through the hopper. I showed you on page 6 is a filling line. That's just to show you that at the end of the line they fill and they wrap these, number 6, is they fill and they wrap the product here. I don't want to spend much time on that. It's not terribly exciting. But let me just conclude with this, and you have two things. You have a soft margarine and a stick margarine. Now, Jerry, I'm going to ask you to, I won't have to stumble over my words. Can you explain to us, Jerry, I'd like you to explain to us the difference between a soft margarine, a stick margarine, and when must something by law be called a spread? And then, Jerry, I'm going to ask you to let us know about what percent, when you talk about a dairy margarine, not just much of what Bendura is labeled as OUD, but that's because it goes over your OUD dairy equipment. So, but then you have stuff that genuinely contains dairy ingredients. So I'm going to ask you, Jerry, to your experience, what percentage of dairy might be in the standard stick-based stick margarine? So,
stick-based margarine?
Yeah.
No answer on the mic.
Let me start by saying that margarine has a standard of identity as well. And the standard of identity for margarine is 80% oil. Must be 80% oil. So if you have spreads, what we call a spread, there is no standard of identity for spread. So spreads are less than 80% oil. Now you'll see 60% spreads, you'll see 52% spreads, you'll see 40% spreads. Depends on how much fat the manufacturer wants to put into the product. As far as the percentage of dairy is concerned, typically if you're looking at a butter blend, it's usually about 10% butter. If you're looking at a margarine that does not have butter in it, it can be less than 0.5% dairy because it's a flavor. And typically the flavors will be dairy-based. Now they do make some butter flavors that are parve. There are, in fact, a lot of them available, and that's how you get a parve margarine, really. You get a buttery kind of a flavor. Now, I'm sure everybody's aware of the problem with diacetyl recently. And diacetyl is a naturally occurring butter flavor. But somebody got sick from it once upon a time, so now it's kind of persona non grata.
Okay, we'll stick around, Jerry. Yeah. We're going to conclude. I've got to be fed up by Rabbi Luban, so we'll be here for another 5 minutes. But what I wanted to say, okay, so you have the soft, you have the stick. The soft is a matter of oil that you said. What I wanted to follow up on what Jerry said, which was important, what did you say the average percentage was of a dairy component? Sometimes it'll
dairy
be...
It's
not only the flavors, but you might have a buttermilk solid in there, too.
There may be some buttermilk solids. There may be some whey.
Right.
But typically the amount of dairy in it is not that great. The difference, by the way, between the stick margarine and the soft margarine is not in the oil, but rather in the type of oil. The stick margarine has more of a partially hydrogenated fraction than the soft margarine does. It may have more totally hydrogenated oils, what we call soy flake. And that's what adjusts the melt point of the margarine. Soft margarine obviously melts at a lower temperature than stick margarine does.
Okay, but I wanted to bring out, though, for what Jerry was, the minute percent, even in a dairy, genuinely dairy margarine, the amount of dairy that's in there is quite minute. So at least by weight, volume might be a little more tricky, but at least by weight, it's probably not more than 1%. Is that correct?
Well, you may see some as high as 5%.
That's in a butter blend.
Well, butter blend will be 10%. You may see some with a higher buttermilk content.
Right, but generally speaking, the average store brand dairy margarines that you see, the well-known brands, are less than 1% of total dairy, which means, again, you might have to adjust for by volume. But generally speaking, they are under the shear of Bittel. Sometimes they are borderline. One particular company comes to mind. It happens to be 1.6% is dairy, and a major margarine, dairy margarine. Now, what that means is, I'm not going to poskin here, but I will just tell you that what you have to consider in halacha, and this I heard from Rav Herschel Schechter, you have to consider this in halacha in any case. This comes up all the time. Oi, Gavali, Rabbi, we found my wife or me. I cooked by accident, made my potatoes my fleishik of potatoes and made it with dairy margarine. So you have to realize, you got to remember that the margarine is not, it's heter beheter, unless you're going to treat stam cholov as treif, otherwise it's heter beheter. The milk is kosher, the oil is kosher, so therefore it's not nasis nevela, and therefore you can assume that the amount of dairy that's in the margarine combined with the potatoes that you've now added to it, the milk will become now bottle. And even if it's you basted a chicken with it, so that the amount of milk the chicken combines with the oil against the original percentage of milk, this is, again, I'm not poskini, but you can consider this the halacha, that the margarine, the amount of milk in the margarine will become bottle. Rabbi Lubin is here, and I know he'll probably be thinking that, yeah, but it depends if there are bikayim, if you have crevices where the margarine still remains intact, and you can see that they pool, the margarine pools in the chicken crevices, then you may have a problem because the margarine is intact. But otherwise, if the margarine is totally absorbed in the ingredient, even if it's milchika margarine with a fleishik application, bidi eved, this is, again, I'm not posking, I'll say this one more time, but it's something for either at home or for a bonum to consider. And Jerry, I'm going to close with you. Can you tell us something about beta carotene in margarine and how it affects Passover production?
Beta carotene is used as a coloring agent. Typically, it is solubilized in soybean oil, and for Passover, that's not acceptable. And we used to make a Passover margarine, but were unable to get beta carotene for a period of time that was kosher for Passover. We used up what we had, basically, and then had to stop production. Now there's now a new source, I believe, that
there is one source, yeah.
Yeah, that has been found. So I'm not sure that we're going to be doing that this year. I do know that we just had a Passover run at our California plant of cottonseed oil. Packed some drums that are going to go to a manufacturer that uses the oil in aerosol sprays. But I'm not sure if we're going to be doing any Passover margarine.
Okay, thank you very much. Before I actually conclude, I suggest, related to that is aerosol sprays. Aerosol sprays also, even if they're marked dairy, many of them contain a very minute component. You got to realize that there's a butter flavor in the areas in this spray, but the butter flavor itself might only contain a certain percentage of real dairy. So most of them, even though they're marked OUD, naturally you have to treat it like dairy. You know, there's issues of TOM, I know that. But still, the amount of actual dairy is bottled. So often, b'di'evet, it may not make the product trade. Thank you very much.